Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Good morning, I'm Taylor Wilson, and this is 5 Things You Need to Know Wednesday, the 1st of December, 2021. Today, the Supreme Court's latest abortion case, plus updates from a deadly Michigan school shooting, and more. Here are some of the top headlines. Japan continues to work to shut down its border amid fears of the Omicron COVID-19 variant. The country has banned foreign visitors and is now asking international airlines to stop taking reservations at all through the end of December. CNN has suspended anchor Chris Cuomo for helping his brother, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, during sexual harassment scandals. Transcripts out this week reveal he worked with sources and talked strategy to help Andrew Cuomo before his resignation in August. And scientists have found the oldest remains of a close relative to the modern human. Found in Siberia, the bones are 200,000 years old, the oldest found remains of Denisovans, a sister population of Neanderthals. The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in a case surrounding the Mississippi abortion ban. The law bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy and represents a direct challenge to the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision establishing the constitutional right to abortion. Supreme Court correspondent John Fritzy has more on what to expect from the case and the precedent it could set going forward.
One thing I would say is that, you've got a 9-member court and you sort of know where roughly 6 of them are going to go. And I think what we're going to be doing is looking very closely at 3 justices, for a lack of a better term, in the middle. And those justices are Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Barrett. All of those justices have talked about, I think, or in opinions have written about their general opposition to abortion. However, you know, they've got to balance that opposition against this idea of upholding precedent, right? A lot of folks feel that the court gets its legitimacy and its power through upholding past precedent. So they've got to figure out a way to do that. They've got to strike that balance. And I think what folks will be looking for is, you know, is there any clue in how they ask their questions about which way those 3 are leaning? Those are the 3 that really could sort of decide this case. I mean, the other thing to watch out for is the framing that is going on around this case, even before it's decided. Advocates on both sides, of course, this is really important for them. And you see a lot of debate about, well, what if the court doesn't overturn Roe, but upholds the Mississippi law? In other words, is there a sort of a middle ground here where the court could say, all right, Mississippi, you can keep your ban on abortions after 15 weeks, but we're going to say that we're upholding Roe? And there's a lot of debate about whether that's even possible. Advocates for abortion rights say it's not possible. Anti-abortion advocates say, well, maybe it is. There may be some middle ground that the court can strike. The court often doesn't like to do big things. It likes to move incrementally. And the question here is there a way to do that? And it's just not clear. It's not clear yet that there is.
Check out more Supreme Court coverage on usatoday.com. Charges are expected today after authorities say a 15-year-old student opened fire at a suburban Detroit high school yesterday, killing at least 3 other students.
I don't understand how someone, anyone, could do to a community what has been done.
Pastor Jesse Holt at a morning yesterday. The shooting came at Oakland High School, about 35 miles from Detroit, and Oakland County Sheriff Michael Bouchard said the student's semi-automatic handgun was purchased just days before the shooting.
Preliminary investigation revealed that the weapon used in the shooting was purchased on November 26th. 4 days ago by the boy's father. The gun had 15-round magazines. We found two of them. The person that's got the most insight of the motive is not talking. So if we find anything in any of the evidence that we've seized, whether it be a phone dump or any evidence that was seized from the home, obviously that leads towards motive, that will be something we're very much looking for.
Those killed are 16-year-old Tate Meyer, 14-year-old Hannah St. Juliana, and 17-year-old Madison Baldwin, and another eight people were injured. Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald said last night that her office expects to issue charges quickly, with more information out today. Because he's a minor and has not been charged as an adult, the shooter's identity has still not yet been released. An expert advisory panel from the FDA has signed off on the first antiviral drug to treat COVID-19. The drug molnupiravir comes from Merck and Ridgeback Biotherapeutics and is intended to be used in unvaccinated people at risk for severe COVID-19 within 5 days of the start of symptoms. Until now, the only treatment to try and keep people with COVID out of the hospital has been monoclonal antibodies, which must be delivered by shot or infusion. Dr. David Hardy and Dr. Richard Murphy differed on the Antimicrobial Drugs Advisory Committee.
As a frontline clinician and treating patients, both inpatient and outpatient, there is a need for something like this.
I voted no. It was a difficult decision. I think it came down to the fact that under the most ideal circumstances, it had a very modest efficacy and very uncertain efficacy against Delta.
Ultimately, the panel only narrowly voted to authorize the drug for emergency use by a 13-10 vote. The FDA will now make a final decision on the drug's authorization, but typically follows the panel's recommendation. Meanwhile, a debate continues on vaccine mandates. As we said in yesterday's show, legal fights continue surrounding whether the federal government can require workers to get vaccinated. But as investigative reporter Craig Harris tells us, employers are mostly taking matters into their own hands.
The survey that came out from Willis Towers Watson, it's a national firm, and it ended up doing a survey back in mid-November with 543 U.S. employers that employ about 5.2 million workers. And what they found is that more than half of those companies, 57%, said they're either going to require or they're going to plan to require a COVID-19 vaccination for their employees. Now, one thing that's been a concern is whether this vaccination mandate would cause resignations, which has been an issue with some police departments and fire departments across the country. But the survey found that just very few employers, only 3%, reported that their vaccination mandate actually had a spike in resignations. Now, it doesn't define what a spike is, but it doesn't look like it has been a huge, huge impact. On the other hand, it says that nearly half, almost 48%, believe that the vaccine mandate could help recruit and retain employees. So it could become a good thing for some businesses, which, you know, the issue we have, you know, more than half of the businesses are saying that they are going to do this vaccination, which kind of aligns with where the percentage is with the entire country of who's vaccinated. A couple other things that the survey found is that nearly one in five employers believe that their employee vaccination rate was less than 50%. And a third believe that 75% or more of their employees had been vaccinated. Employees will continue to offer testing, almost half, 47%. They're either unsure or they're not decided what type of testing they're going to do, but they will do testing. And then when it comes to exemptions, over half of the respondents, just over 51%, said they're going to, the folks who are requiring the vaccination said they will evaluate for medical exemptions. And then another 58% said they'll evaluate internally for religious exemptions. So, you know, what this shows is that, you know, as the businesses, even though they're having a tough time retaining employees and keeping them on the job, which during this time, which is called the Great Resignation, they still want to vaccinate their staff. They want their employees to do that. And so they want them to follow these rules that are coming from the Biden administration.
For Craig's full story, check out today's episode description. Major League Baseball is about to go dark, and maybe for the entire winter. At midnight tonight, the league's collective bargaining agreement with the Players Association expires. And for the first time in nearly 30 years, that deadline will pass without ratifying a new agreement. In response, MLB will likely lock out all of its players and table all transactions until both sides can come together. But how long will the lockout last? USA Today Sports' Mackenzie Salmon and Bob Nightingale consider.
All right, Bob, fair or foul? This is the last baseball we are going to see for a while because the work stoppage delay is going to delay opening day next year.
I go foul. I still think we're going to have opening day on time. I mean, both sides have way too much to lose. You're talking about the teams, you know, say they lost $3 billion last year. The players lost two-thirds of their salaries. They can't. Will they have a deal by December 1st? Who knows? But, you know, why not December 8th or 15th? You know, what have you. As they can't even afford, though, to miss one day of spring training without the fan just going, you know, ballistic. And baseball's got to be careful. You know, I mean, it's not as popular as it once was. You know, ESPN's dropping baseball, you know, next year. They're just doing Sunday night only. Rings are down. Attendance is down. They got to be very careful here.
You can stay up on all things baseball, including some recent big free agent moves, at USA Today Sports. Well, we already know about extreme temperatures and rising oceans because of climate change, but a new USA Today investigation is also highlighting climate change's effect on rainfall. In the investigation called Downpour, out today, reporters reveal a stunning shift in the way precipitation falls in the U.S., east of the Rockies, more rain is falling and in more intense bursts. But in the West, people are waiting longer to see any rain at all. When they do, it's extremely irregular. Climate change is affecting so-called atmospheric rivers, or concentrated moisture in the atmosphere. Climate change makes them warmer, more intense, and more frequent, as climate scientist Daniel Swain from the National Center for Atmospheric Research explains.
The fact that we're seeing so many atmospheric rivers that are of this sustained intensity and also as warm as they are is what is unusual and what has produced the extreme flooding we've seen up in British Columbia and the somewhat lesser degree of flooding elsewhere as well. Really warm atmospheric rivers produce mostly rain rather than snow. And so all of that liquid water runs off pretty much immediately into rivers, causing an earlier and larger flood peak.
For more, search climate on usatoday.com. And you can find 5 Things 7 mornings a week right here, wherever you're listening right now. Thanks to PJ Elliott for his great work on the show, and I'm back tomorrow with more of 5 Things from USA Today.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.